Today's Teisho is case 84 in the Hekigan Roku, the Pien Lu. Case 84 is entitled Wi Ma's, the Gate to the One and Only. Engo's introduction. There is nothing right that can truly be called right. There is no wrong that can truly be called wrong. With right and wrong eliminated, gains and losses are forgotten. It is all naked and exposed. Now I want to ask you, what is in front of me and what is behind me? Some monk may come forward and say that in front there are the Buddha hall and the temple gate, and behind the bedroom and the sitting room. Tell me, is that man open-eyed? If you can see through him, I will acknowledge that you have seen the ancient worthies. Main subject. Wi Ma asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Manjushri answered, to my mind, in all dharmas, there are no worlds, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. This is entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri said to Wi Ma, each of us has had his say. Now I want to ask you, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Secho says, what did Wi Ma say? And again he says, I have seen through him. Secho's verse, you foolish old Wi Ma Shitsu, sorrowful for ancient beings. You lie sick in Bialy, your body all withered up. The teacher of the seven Buddhas comes. The room is cleared of everything. You ask for the gate to the one and only. Are you repulsed by Manju's words? No, not repulsed. The golden-haired lion can find you nowhere. Today is day two of our spring sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for making a serious effort this morning. I know that some of you were really struggling last night and this morning. We sit for a long time in the morning. We sit for an hour and a half without any break. That's a very long time to sit. And of course, our evening sitting schedule is quite rigorous also. It's difficult to sit still by the second period of meditation. And I know how hard it must be for some of you because this is your first sesshin. And I want you to realize that everybody in the room has gone through what you're going through. The first time I came to sesshin, I had a lot of ideas about what might happen at a Zen retreat. I had read very little about Zen practice. I had read books about Zen philosophy. I had read Alan Watts's fascinating book, The Way of Zen, in which he says that Zen masters really didn't think it was necessary to do Zazen. I thought he was right until I actually ran into a Zen monk who taught me how to sit. And I had read other books on Buddhist thinking and philosophy, but I hadn't really practiced. And when I came to a sesshin, it was a total shock to my system. And my teacher, Genki Roshi, had just come from Japan. And this was his first sesshin here in the United States. And I had done a little sitting with the Seattle Zen Center, where the sits were about 25 minutes long. And Genki Roshi announced at the first day of the sesshin that the sits would be the standard Ryutakuji length of 45 minutes. And that nobody in the group had practiced sitting for 45 minute sits. And by about, I think we got up too at about 4:30 and came to the cushion at 5. And I would imagine that by about 7 o'clock in the morning, I was really totally wiped out. You know? And I can remember just being constantly in pain, you know, constantly in pain. And I remember going into the Dokusan room, it just literally crawling into the Dokusan room. It seemed like just there was no posture I could find that wasn't painful. And I was just trying to survive from one sit to the next. And I remember going back to the bunkhouse and just crashing in the bed and just passing out into like a black slumber. And then having the alarm go off and getting up and dragging myself back in and sitting on the cushion again and just staying one breath away from the pain. It was difficult, you know. The oddest thing was that when it was over and I left and I went back to my apartment in Seattle, I got up the next day and I felt strangely buoyant, strangely good. I felt really, really safe and secure and protected. You know, when I was a little boy, I used to have a blanket I was thinking about this blanket just recently. I used to have a blanket when I was a little boy that was white wool, and it had a satin trim along the top. And the satin was sort of a pinkish, silvery satin. And that used to be my bed blanket. And I used to, I hate this, this is going to sound just ridiculous, but when I was a little kid, I used to suck my thumb. And I mean really little. I've stopped doing that since then. I want you to know. I used to take the blanket and put the silk part to my cheek, and then I would stick my thumb in my mouth and I would go to sleep. And then, of course, I had to go to college and that stuff. but it was, I remember that, even now, how protected I felt and wonderful. And after the sesshin, I think I had the best sleep of my life since I lost track of that blanket. And I got up the next day and I had to go to school and teach my class. And I remember going into my classroom and starting to lecture my students. And I remember I turned to the blackboard and my mind went totally blank. And I thought, you know, what the hell am I doing up here, you know? So I looked at my notes, I sort of got it together, you know, and I looked and they didn't seem to be, there weren't shocked looks on their faces. And I just thought, wow, what was that all about, you know? My mind just went totally blank. Even though I had been in a lot of pain throughout the first sesshin, I actually signed up to do another sesshin. And I think it was a mystery to me for many years why I was signing up for these sesshin. But I understand much better now, after doing this for 35 years, that even below the threshold of my consciousness, I was feeling better. You know, I didn't. If somebody had asked me, you know, during the first session, how are you doing? I would have said, this is murder, you know. But all the same, there were these moments during that first session where my mind was totally at rest, totally still and at rest. I remember there was a bat, there was a, where we used to do our session was a summer camp for kids. And somebody had built this big sink. It was like a metal tank, like a metal swimming pool almost. It was this big zinc round sink. And there were all these taps, and water would flow into this big sink. So you had like about 12 faucets, I should say, faucets all emptying into this big sink. And you could turn it on, and basically you could wash your face, and like 12 people could wash their face at the same time. And instead of having 12 sinks, you had one giant sink. Now that I think back on it, I can't imagine who invented that or what purpose it could serve. But the interesting thing was that as I was watching the water hit the sink, the surface of the sink, and it was making this drumming sound, it was so beautiful. It was just unspeakably beautiful. And I remember it even now, 35 years later, you know, just being deeply moved by just the sound of water hitting a metal sink. And I guess throughout that session, I had these moments where it was like the boundary between myself and the world disappeared, and I felt so connected. It's like being in your mother's arms or being in your father's arms, you know, safe, at home, at ease. And there were these glimpses of this condition during that first session, even though I was in agony a lot of the time. And when the session was over, I remembered this feeling of well-being or connectedness. And it was enough to make me sign up for another session, and then another one, and another one. And if somebody had said to me, "Why are you doing this?" I would have said, "I don't know. I don't know." Because it wasn't conscious. I didn't say consciously, I'm feeling a sense of well-being, you know, after many years of uneasiness, you know. But it was like speaking to me on a deeper level, speaking to me on a deeper level. So if this is your first session and you're in agony, I want you to know that it's not agony for the next 35 years, that there's going to come a time when you begin to be consciously aware of some kind of a transformation in the nature of your experience. I remember another session we did years after my first session. It was, we used to have no place of our own where we would do session, so Glenn Webb would go out and look for locations, and we were sort of a transient vagabond sangha. We would have session here and session there. Some places were truly terrible. We had session once at a Catholic school. We were having the session in one part of the building, and they were having the prom in the other part of the building. And we actually did walk through the prom area on our way to eat. And this is like, it was like a hallucination, right? We'd done zazen all day, right? And it's all just like a blur. It's like, did that really happen? But it really did. And I remember we had to go through these girls are in their pink and blue dresses, and these guys are in their tuxedos, you know, and we're scurrying through in robes or in our, you know, civilian clothes. It was so weird. And by the way, somebody robbed us, right? At the cabinet. I don't want you to reach any conclusion, but somebody went through the drawers and pulled money out of people's wallets and stuff like that. So anyway, we had a lot of different we had session at a lot of different locations, and one of them was at Moses Lake and that was really magical. We had rented a space in this park, Moses Lake State Park, which is out on the eastern part of Washington State, which is actually desert, like New Mexico. And it was very hot. And by the way, Mount St. Helens blew up during that session. I was sitting on the toilet at the end of the day of Zazen. No, I guess it wasn't the end of the day. I take that back. It was in the late afternoon, and I was sitting on the toilet, and I was looking at the windowsill, and all of a sudden I thought, my God, I'm hallucinating like crazy, because it was like sand started building up in the windowsill, right? And I thought, that is the weirdest thing. It's like I'm seeing, I rub my eyes, you know, and then there really was sand there. I thought, that's the weirdest thing. And then later I learned that Mount St. Helens had blown up, you know, a volcano had erupted hundreds of miles away, but it blew sand into the windows of our bathroom. But anyway, during that session, that was the first time I ever really got beyond pain when I sat. And I remember sitting all day and suddenly entering this state in which I absolutely had zero pain. It really happened. And it was astonishing to me, you know. I just felt invulnerable. And I remember going in at the end of the day, going to Dokusan and saying to Genki Roshi, "Genki Roshi, I have no pain." You know, I was like, look at this, you know, and grab my legs, you know. And I said, I'll never feel pain again. And of course, the next day I got it, I was like, oh my God, my legs. But there is a state in which your mind becomes really imperturbable. You know, if you watch the breath, you'll have a moment where, you know, maybe 15 minutes into the sit, where you begin to hurt, and you can count on that coming. You know, you can count on it. It's going to happen. And so, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, there are many things you could think about. You could think about your summer vacation, you could think about sex, you could think about, but what you should think about is the pain is about 10 minutes away, right? And then you should say, where is my breath? And you should find your breath, and you should fix your mind like a flashlight on your breath. And then when you begin to feel discomfort, you'll be ready to meet it, yeah? And as the pain arises, if you begin to feel pain, say, in your knee, whatever you do, don't form a mental image of the pain in your knee. Just be ambiently aware of pain and focus your attention on your breath. And you watch the breath like a flashlight. You know, you just follow the first breath out. You follow the next breath out. You'll notice that when you follow the breath out, actually, if you're really fixing your attention on the breath, there's no room for pain awareness to arise. It's only at the end of the breath that you become more acutely aware of the pain. And the pain tends to arise at the end of the breath, right? And then you want to go back to the breath again, and you take another breath, and the pain goes away. So it's going to be, the pain goes away and then comes back. And then it goes away and it comes back. And it goes away and it comes back. But eventually, if you keep doing this, you're going to reach a state where you feel much better, where the pain is no longer screaming in your ear, but it's like a distant murmur. It's always there, like a little bit of a nagging ache. But it's no longer like this emergency situation, right? And this will really happen. And you'll get to a place, if you can just keep doing this, you'll get to this place that's like an eye of a tornado. It's like all around you, there is a commotion, but you're centered in this very stable, calm place. And if you just hang in there, that will happen. As I said this morning, if you start moving, you set in motion a chain reaction where of thinking and moving, and thinking and moving, and you'll be unable to, it'll be hard to arrest that process. You'll just keep shaking. And when you move around, you know, remember there's 28 other people here trying not to move, and they're sitting there saying, "Ring the bell, ring the bell, ring the bell. I don't want to move. Don't move. One, two, three. Don't move. Don't move. Don't move. Don't ring the bell, you bastard." You know? Okay. Meanwhile, next door, there's somebody going, or looking at his hands, or having a stretch, right? And that's like you're on a diet and somebody's eating a piece of cake in front of you, right? And you're being electrocuted too. So don't, you're making it harder for other people not to move when you're throwing the towel in that way. You know, so when you're strong, you're being strong for other people too. It's like you're helping other people while you help yourself. So I'm not trying to guilt trip you, but other people are working very hard to help you to be still. So please appreciate their efforts. And it's especially inappropriate to move if you're not in pain, if you just want a good stretch. That's really like very, it's really disrespectful to other people. So please don't do that. You know, make a special effort. And you know what happens to people is that as you do this, you know, you develop an ability to get beyond the small self, we say, you know. This is really like crude, you know. Struggling with pain is so crude, right? Because you know, when we think of meditation, we think of very mystical, magical things. You know, I remember my first sesshin, I really did think that there was going to be some kind of mystical initiation. I really did. I mean, I was not a stupid person, but I really thought maybe when I would go to this, you know, I'd see pictures of Tibetan monks doing sand paintings and things. I thought, maybe we'll do a sand painting, or maybe we'll, you know, but in fact, we just did zazen, zazen, zazen. And you know, the pain is so crude, and it's so blunt, and it's, you know, but it's so liberating in a certain way, right? Because, you know, we have all of these ideas, and we have likes and dislikes and expectations and so on. And then when you encounter this blunt pain, which is so crude, you can't really think your way out of it or rationalize, and it cuts through all the crap, you know. It cuts through all the preferences, you know. Maybe you come to sesshin and you're worried about something in the office, some office politics. You know, maybe somebody, the boss, seems to like somebody more than you. Or maybe you're at school and you got an 86 on your exam and you really think you should have gotten a 92. And it's eating you up, right? And you come to sesshin and you sit down on the cushion and it's now day two and your legs are screaming. And suddenly, you know, the 82 versus the 96 or whatever no longer matters. It's just like, I just want to survive. And this is a very pure state of being. This is very pure, very purifying, right? Because now I've just thrown away everything else in the universe except trying to get through this 25-minute period of meditation. And it's like I've given up everything except this moment, and I'm just going to try to get through this breath, you know, and then I'm going to try to get through the next breath. So the universe is like contracted down to one instant. And this is incredibly liberating, even though this is incredibly purifying. And it's like your whole attention is down to one instant, and the pain is sort of nipping at your heels, you know. So you've got to be on top of it. And, you know, you begin to feel the pain, you go, whoa. And you begin to feel the pain, two, three, see. And if you can't get organized. You know, you're just going to be there sitting in agony for 25 minutes and you'll be moving around and moving around, trying futilely to get into a comfortable posture. But if you straighten your back and you breathe with the dantian, the hara, you contract your abdomen with every breath and you follow the breath out, you know, you fix your mind like a flashlight, you're going to be ready to receive that pain, to deal with that pain. You sweep the pain away, you sweep the pain away, you sweep the pain away, and finally you're going to get to this place, as I say, that's very still and stable. And this is a wonderful achievement. This is the beginning of liberation. What is it called here? It's called the gate to the one and only. In this state, you know, you're hardly even a person anymore. It's like, Kurt, who cares about Kurt? You know, I just want to get through the next breath, see? And it's like, you know, maybe you came to Sesshin and you thought, this haircut doesn't look very good. You know, I'll never go back to that place, you know. You walk into the Zendo and think, what must they think? This haircut, you know, okay, right? But day two of Sesshin, it's like you wouldn't care if your hair was falling out, right? All you care about is getting through the next breath. This is so important, you know. One of my favorite books is War and Peace. And the hero of Prince Bezukhov is he's the richest man in Russia. And the first part of the book is all about his attempts to be happy. And he tries everything. You know, he tries to, you know, be in high society. He wants people to admire him. He spends tons of his money to impress people. None of it makes him happy. And then Napoleon invades Russia and everything falls apart. And he winds up living with this peasant, you know. And he's so amazed that the peasant is able to be happy without any of the things he thought, Bezukhov thought were essential. And suddenly, you know, Bezukhov himself is really happy. And he's happy just to have, like, some bread in the morning, right? Just like, you know, before his servants would have brought in all these different, he would have, you know, lifted up the plate, you know, sturgeon again, sturgeon eggs, no, you know, poached, I don't like poached eggs, bring me, you know, but, you know, suddenly just having a piece of bread to eat is like heaven. And I think there's great wisdom in that. It's great wisdom. You know, Zen meditation 101 is all about entering that state where you think, I don't care about my haircut, or I don't care about, you know, all I want to do is be in this moment and get to the other end of the 25-minute period. And what's often the case is, you know, you're sitting on the cushion, you're trying to get through the sit, you're focusing intently on 1 second, and then another second, and another second. At the end of the sit, you know, you can hear the sound of the wind, or you can go in and have a meal, and it will be strangely delicious. And if you begin to inspect the way you feel, you might realize that you feel thrillingly alive. Really. You know, one of the things I like to do is hike. I like to hike. And this summer I had the chance to do a 50-mile hike in the mountains of Wyoming. And it was murder. It was like the first 5 hours were straight up. And I was sweating like I soaked my t-shirt. When I got to the camp, I was so tired I couldn't even move. My friend Larry Sullivan pitched the tent. And I crawled into the tent and you know, conked out. And the next day I got up and I was so sore. And I put on my pack and we walked another 10 miles. And we got there and I fell down and I just sat. I thought, kill me now. You know? And Larry made the meal and he pitched the tent. And I was able to put the spoon in my own mouth, you know. And then I fell into a black slumber and woke up, you know, okay. At the end of it all, if somebody had said, how did you feel about it? I would have gone, great, you know, great, fantastic, you know. There's something about getting beyond the small self, right? Getting beyond the small self is so great. You know, it's why people, you know, sail across the Pacific Ocean in a little boat, or why they jump out of, you know, airplanes with parachutes. You know, you're terrified all the way down, and then you don't get killed, and you think, God, I'd like to do that again, you know? Okay, so Zazen is a lot like that, you know? It's simplifying radically, being just in the moment. And we always have all these conditions for our existence. You know, we say, if I have this, everything will be great. And if I don't have this, everything will be terrible. And this moment's no good because this isn't here. And there's something so crude and primitive about early stages of Zazen. But there's something so liberating. You know, you get off the cushion and you feel like, you can feel, and maybe it hasn't happened to you yet, but you can feel like every atom of your being has been scrubbed by little cleaners, you know. And that's a wonderful feeling. Now, this process goes on and on in Zen practice, and it becomes more sophisticated. It's not just about crude things like pain in our legs, but it can be other sources of pain and unhappiness in our lives. You know, when we sit down on the cushion and we're working with koans, sometimes we have, there are experiences in our lives that have blocked us. You know, they've blocked us. And they create contradictions that we just can't seem to get out of, you know. There's so many of these things, you know. I have a friend of mine whose father wanted him to be a concert pianist. And his father was a concert pianist and composer and a music teacher in Seattle. And he wanted his son, John, to go into the arts. And John was interested in the sciences. John had a lot of problems with his parents from early on. His father, they began to have so many problems that John's father sent him to a military academy, like a military school. And if you've ever met my friend John, it's the very worst place in the world for him. My friend John was literally a born hippie, you know. He just doesn't like rules, let me put it that way. And he loves, having a good time. He smoked for 40 years. He likes pot, you know. He knows how to have fun. And it must have been hell for him to be in the military school. And I think what hurt him most of all was being sent away by his parents. And I think on some level he never felt loved by his parents, you know. And so it was very, very, very difficult for him not to become what his father wanted him to be, you know, but to do something instead that was really his true nature. And he went on to become a brain scientist. But I imagine that it must have been a tremendous struggle to make that decision, you know, where you're trying to have your father's love or your mother's love, and they keep saying, if you want our love, you have to become a musician, you know, and then to somehow find the way to follow your own path and at the same time feeling, you know, like you're not getting that nourishment of that love, you know. I think these issues came up for my friend in his Zen practice, you know. At a certain point in his career, I think he felt very blocked in his work as a neuroscientist. And I think he felt that he wasn't, he had cut himself off from that love that he never got as a kid, and his work as a scientist suddenly became very empty. And I think this was something he did a lot of zazen to work through, you know. And so I hope I'm making sense, but we all have these contradictions or these stories in our lives, these things that keep us from being fully aware, fully present, you know. We all get wounded in our lives, and then it's very hard to be in the moment without fear or guilt or anger. If you have parents who were always berating you or even were physically aggressive towards you, you know, that colors every moment of your life. It just does. You know, and it's hard then to be spontaneous and alive. You're always carrying these injuries around with you. Maybe you always, you know, at some level, your default position is, I feel like crap, I feel valueless, or so, you know. Zen practice isn't just about something like overcoming that crude experience of pain. It's also about working through these obstacles, these walls inside of ourselves, and having a kind of unified mind. You know, suddenly, you know, you can get beyond your image of yourself, and you can be in the moment in a spontaneous, open way. You know, the more advanced stages of Zen practice are all about working through these psychological barriers and experiencing the real openness of our lives. You know, that we have this real openness. You know. You come to Sesshin sometime feeling blue, you know, depressed maybe. And you feel boxed in and trapped. Or you feel unvalued. Or you feel like life has passed you by. You know, those kinds of feelings that we all have. And there's a huge history to all these feelings. And you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, and maybe pain is not the problem now. It's a psychological pain. You know, but eventually what happens is you get to this state where you suddenly have that same imperturbable stability. It's like, oh, here's my blanket. I forgot about it, you know? And it, you know, you might not put your thumb in your mouth and hold it up to your cheek, but it's like you're back in this place that's very nurturing and protective and safe. And it's always there. It's always there. But we get distracted. You know, as we're growing up, things happen to us. We get injured or terrified or neglected, right? And so we forget that this place is there. And we want, you know, Hakuin says we're like people who are up to their necks in water, but we're dying of thirst. You know, we're up to our necks in this wonderful wholeness, and yet we feel homeless all the time. You know, or can feel homeless all the time. As Zen practice goes on, you're encountering that you work through your barriers, and little by little, you get back to this place which is safe, connected, whole. And sometimes we get there and we can't quite believe it, you know. Every once in a while we stumble into wholeness, you know. And it's like we might just be there for a second and we think, oh, I don't deserve this. or this can't be real, or you know, or this can't be happening to me, you know. And then we go back into our familiar habits. But every once in a while, you know, we stumble into it and we go, damn, you know, this is wonderful. You know, this is wonderful. Sometimes people come to see me and they say, oh my God, I feel like $1 million, right? You know? And I think sometimes we feel we don't deserve to feel like $1 million, you know. But that's always there, you know, that condition is always there under the surface. One of the things that Zen tells us, and it really goes back to ancient Buddhist teachings, is that the secret to getting back to that place is not necessarily, or is not really, in our external circumstances. And this is, I think, quite important. You know, I have a friend of mine who is an associate professor, and he's been an associate professor for 40 years. He'll probably retire as an associate professor. Now, if you don't know anything about professors, professor is professor, right? So if somebody introduces you and says, I'm a professor at Rutgers, you might think, great, that's very impressive, or it's not impressive at all, or whatever. But if you're in the world of professors, there's a distinction between an associate professor and a professor. And in fact, to make it the distinctions even more significant, there's an associate professor, there's a professor, and then there's a professor two. Okay? And the professor two gets to wear special shoulder pads, you know, and a special hat. Not really. No. But it's a distinction, right, that's some people die for, right? And there are people who retire feeling really sad because they never made it to P1 or P2. Or there's P1s who feel, if only I had made it to P2, you know. Now, you know, Buddhism would say, look, please, if you like to be a professor, be a professor. But you know, if you're thinking about your happiness, please don't assume that getting P2 is going to solve the problem. Because if you feel like crap, if you feel inferior or you feel unloved, getting the P2 probably isn't going to change that. You'll just, instead of being, you'll be an associate professor who feels unloved and an associate professor who feels like crap, and then you'll be a professor, but you'll still feel that way, you know. And then you'll look to the P2 and go, oh, if only I had a P2, and then you get a P2 and you go, well, if only I had a titled chair, you know, if only I was the Witherspoon chair in something, you know. And then you think, well, his chair has a bigger endowment than my chair, right? This is like a restless mind looking for something it's looking for something in the wrong place, Buddhism would say. Looking in the wrong place. So the Buddhist view is the external circumstance is not the decisive factor. Now, it doesn't mean if your boss is mean to you, you should take it. And it doesn't mean you should give up your dreams and so on and so on. But what it means is the key is in your own relationship to the moment. See? Now, this, you know, so basically, you know, people have this extraordinary experience sometime when they meditate, where they're sitting on the cushion and they're abjectly miserable because they're a professor, an associate professor, instead of a professor. Or they're abjectly miserable because, you know, whatever. And all of a sudden, in spite of everything, they fall into this state which is absolutely wonderful. And it suddenly becomes unimportant whether they're a professor or not, you know? And in that state, they often, there's the blanket, right? There's the blanket. And you can lie down and have the most beautiful sleep, or you can walk around and feel so happy, right? And that is enlightenment, really. You know, that condition of being at one with the world, right? Feeling that sense of wholeness or safety or connectedness. You know, that's one way to understand enlightenment. What starts out as a very crude struggle with pain gradually becomes a deeper and deeper process of liberation. Moving is imagining that we can find stillness by adjusting our posture, right? But actually, how you respond to the pain is a mental game. And if you don't move, you find that you can enter this imperturbable place. But the same thing is true, you know, for the psychological anguishes we face in more advanced training, you know. It is important. If you feel you deserve a raise, you should go to your boss and say, "I deserve a raise." And being a Zen student doesn't mean you go, "Oh well, poverty is better. I won't ask for a raise." That's not Zen. Okay. If somebody's pushing you around, practicing nonviolence doesn't mean you lie down on the driveway and say, "Go ahead, drive your car over me." Okay. That's not. But nevertheless, you know, the way out of these compulsive injuries, these compulsive psychological injuries, is not necessarily a change in our circumstances, you know? It's a change in how we deal with our lives from moment to moment, from moment to moment. And so there's something in our habits of mind that make us unhappy. Again and again and again and again, we keep thinking, if I can get this, I'll be happy. And often it's even something that's unattainable, you know, that's unattainable. And maybe we chose it. People get into a situation, we get into a default position which becomes familiar. I know somebody who's like habitually angry. This person can seem nice enough, but under the surface he's murderously angry. And it's probably because his father was abusive to him. He just goes around angry all the time. The interesting thing is that he gets mad at problems at work, he gets mad at things in his relationship, he gets mad, you know, at the politics, and I must say I joined him there, you know, because he talks about the political situation, and we do have some really good angry sessions over that. But the thing is, you know, even if I have the feeling that even if the Democrats took over the country, and even if we set aside 3/4 of America as a wilderness, and all drove sustainable vehicles, and everybody had good health care, my friend would still be angry, you know, because anger is his default position. You know, it's where he has learned to spend his life. It's so hard for him to get out of that place now because he's in his 50s, and it's where he's lived his life. And people can get into that, it could be insecurity, right? It could be kind of insecurity. A feeling of homelessness, you know, homelessness. I myself have that feeling a lot of the time. I left my father's house when I was 17 years old, and I never went back, you know. For a long time, I lived in this apartment, and I don't have memories of a place where I could say, "Oh, this was my home." You know, when I was a little kid, we grew up on military bases, and we would move every two years or so. So that feeling of homelessness is something I carry with me, you know. I have a house now, and I'm not, you know, I have a house. So, but it's, you know, my mental habit is to kind of feel like I don't have a home. And I'm not trying to elicit your sympathy. Everybody has something like this in his life, and usually many things like this. But, you know, when I sit down on the cushion, every once in a while I feel like I am really home, you know, and it's really sweet. And I can remember the first time that happened to me. I was at a session, and I feel so safe and connected and so at ease right now. It's amazing. So I'm home. I'm home. It could have been anywhere, really. You know, home is really something that's here right now in the moment. Case 84 is Vima is Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti. He's a bodhisattva who lived as a householder. The bodhisattva Vimalakirti was deeply enlightened, but lived as a householder in a village. And basically he went through a daily life as a regular, like, businessman type person. But it was deeply enlightened. And in this case, we're looking at a conversation between the Vima, or Vimalakirti, and Manjushri. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is the bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? And Manjushri said, to my mind, in all dharmas there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. Deep, in other words, mushin. Mushin. That is entering the gate to the one and only. Okay, so Vima, Vimalakirti, asked Manjushri this question. And then Manjushri said to Vima, each of us has had his say. Now I ask you, what is the bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? And basically, Vimalakirti leaves it unanswered. And he leaves it unanswered because each of us has to work through this himself or herself. Each of us has to find, each of us has to break through our own, we all have different barriers. We all have karma. It could be a feeling of homelessness. It could be, murderous rage. It could be a sense of starving for affection. It could be feeling inferior. You know, whatever. We all have this. And so we all have to work through our own barrier. But the answer is always in the moment, according to Buddhism. It's not in the circumstance. Circumstances matter. But our liberation is to be found in our relationship to the moment, to this moment. And if we can change the way we interact with the moment, we can solve many of our problems in a much more satisfactory way. So this is what we're doing at this session. Some of us are just beginning, working through a very crude barrier of physical pain. Now, it's very important to work through the pain barrier, because the truth is, pain is almost inescapable in some form if you're alive. And if you run from pain, you'll run from life. If you find a way to deal with your pain, you can deal with anything in life. You know, you'll have the courage to deal with anything. And then, you know, we go through that barrier, and then we keep going through barrier after barrier after barrier, and those barriers become more refined and more powerful, actually. Pain is not nearly as important in our lives as some of these injuries we've suffered. But if we can work through the pain, that's step one, and eventually we're working through all these karmic barriers. And eventually life can be very beautiful, I would say.